There Palanquin was stopped at the gate, the curtains pulled roughly back by one of the house guards. He had the copper skin and dark almond eyes of a Dothraki, but his face was hairless, and he wore the spiked bronze cap of the Unsullied. He looked them over coldly. Magister Illyrio growled something to him in the rough Dothraki tongue. The guardsman replied in the same voice and waved them through the gates. Danny noticed that her brother's hand was clenched tightly around the hilt of his borrowed sword. He looked almost as frightened as she felt. "Insolent eunuch," the Ceres muttered, as the palanquin lurched up toward the manse. Magistro Illyrio's words were honey. "Many important men will be at the feast tonight. Such men have enemies. The Carl must protect his guests. Yourself chief among them, your grace. No doubt the usurper would pay well for your head."
"Oh, yes," Viserys said darkly. "He has tried, Illyrio, I promise that. His hard knives follow us everywhere. I'm the last dragon, and he will not sleep easy while I live."
The palanquin slowed and stopped. The curtains were thrown back, and a slave offered a hand to help Daenerys out. His colour, she noted, was ordinary bronze. Her brother followed, one hand still clenched hard around his sword hilt. It took two strong men to get Magister Illyrio back on his feet. Inside the manse, the air was heavy with the scent of spices, pinch fire and sweet lemon and cinnamon. They were escorted across the entry hall, where a mosaic of coloured glass depicted the doom of Valyria. Oil burned in black iron lanterns all along the walls. Beneath an arch of twining stone leaves, a eunuch sang their coming.
"Viserys of the House Targaryen, the third of his name," he called in a high, sweet voice. "King of the Andals and the Ronar, and the First Men, Lord of the Seven Kingdoms, and Protector of the Realm, his sister Daenerys Stormborn, Princess of Dragonstone, his honourable host Illyrio Mepatis, Magister of the Free City of Pentos."
They stepped past the eunuch into a pillared courtyard overgrown in pale ivory. Moonlight painted the leaves in shades of bone and silver as the guests drifted among them. Many were Dothraki horse lords, big men with red-brown skin, their drooping mustachios bound in metal rings, their black hair oiled and braided and hung with bells. Yet among them moved bravos and sellswords from Pentos and Myr and Tyrosh, a red priest even fatter than Illyrio, hairy men from the port of Ibn, and lords from the Summer Isles with skins as black as ebony. Daenerys looked at them all in wonder, and realized with a sudden start of fear that she was the only woman there. Illyrio whispered to them, "Those three are Drago's blood riders there," he said. "By the pillars Carl Muro, with his son Rhaegaro. The man with the green beard is brother to the Archon of Tyrosh, and the man behind him is Seer Jorah Mormont." The last name caught Daenerys. "A knight? No less." Illyrio smiled through his beard. "Anointed with the seven oils by the High Septon himself." "What is he doing here?" she blurted. "The usurper wanted his head," Illyrio told them. "Some trifling affront. He sold some poachers to a Tyroshi slaver instead of giving them to the Night's Watch. Absurd law. A man should be able to do as he likes with his own chattel." "I shall wish to speak with Seer Jorah before the night is done," her brother said. Danny found herself looking at the knight curiously. He was an older man, past 40 and balding, but still strong and fit. Instead of silks and cottons, he wore wool and leather. His tunic was a dark green, embroidered with the likeness of a black bear standing on two legs. She was still looking at this strange man from the homeland she had never known, when Magister Illyrio placed a moist hand on her bare shoulder.
"Over there, sweet princess," he whispered. "There is the Carl himself."
Danny wanted to run and hide, but her brother was looking at her, and if she displeased him, she knew she would wake the dragon. Anxiously she turned and looked at the man Viserys hoped would ask to wed her before the night was done. The slave girl had not been far wrong, she thought. Khal Drogo was a head taller than the tallest man in the room, yet somehow light on his feet, as graceful as a panther in Illyrio's menagerie. He was younger than she'd thought, no more than 30. His skin was the colour of polished copper, his thick moustachios bound with gold and bronze rings. "I must go and make my submissions," Magister Illyrio said. "Wait here. I shall bring him to you." Her brother took her by the arm as Illyrio waddled off to the carle, his fingers squeezing so hard that they hurt. "Do you see his braid, sweet sister?" Drogo's braid was black as midnight, and heavy with scented oil, hung with tiny bells that rang softly as he moved. It swung well past his belt, even below his buttocks, the end of it brushing against the back of his thighs. "You see how long it is," Viserys said. "When Dothraki are defeated in combat, they cut off their braids in disgrace, so the world will know their shame. Khal Drogo has never lost a fight. He is Aegon, the Dragon Lord, come again, and you will be his queen." Dany looked at Khal Drogo. His face was hard and cruel, his eyes as cold and dark as onyx. Her brother hurt her sometimes, when she woke the dragon, but he did not frighten her the way this man frightened her. "I don't want to be his queen," she heard herself say in a small, thin voice. "Please, please, Viserys, I don't want to. I want to go home." "Home?" He kept his voice low, but she could hear the fury in his tone. "How are we to go home, sweet sister? They took her home from us." He drew her into the shadows out of sight, his fingers digging into her skin. "How are we to go home?" he repeated, meaning King's Landing and Dragonstone and all the realm they had lost. Dany had only meant their rooms and Illyrio's estate. No true home, surely, though all they had, but her brother did not want to hear that. There was no home there for him. Even the big house with the red door had not been home for him. His fingers dug hard into her arm, demanding an answer. "I don't know," she said at last, her voice breaking, the tears welling in her eyes.
"I do," he said sharply. "We go home with an army, sweet sister, with Khal Drogo's army. That is how we go home. And if you must wed him and bet him for that, you will."
He smiled at her.
"I'll let his whole Khalasar fuck you if need be, sweet sister, all 40,000 men, and their horses too, if that was what it took to get my army. Be grateful is only Drogo. In time, you may even learn to like him. Now dry your eyes, Illyrio is bringing him over, and he will not see you crying."
Dany turned, and saw it was true. Master Illyrio, all smiles and bows, was escorting Khal Drogo over to where they stood. She brushed away unfallen tears with the back of her hand. "Smile," Viserys whispered nervously, his hand falling to the hilt of his sword.
"And stand up straight. Let him see that you have breasts. Guards, no, you have little enough as it is."
Daenerys smiled and stood up straight. Eddard. The visitors poured through the castle gates in a river of gold and silver and polished steel. 300 strong, a pride of bannermen and knights, of sworn swords and free riders. Over their heads a dozen golden banners whipped back and forth in the northern wind, emblazoned with the crown stag of Baratheon. Ned knew many of the riders. There came Sir Jaime Lannister, with hair as bright as beaten gold, and there Sandor Clegane, with his terrible burned face. The tall boy beside him could only be the crown prince, and that stunted little man behind them was surely the imp, Tyrion Lannister. Yet the huge man at the head of the column, flanked by two knights in snow-white cloaks of the King's Guard, seemed almost a stranger to Ned, until he vaulted off the back of his war-horse with a familiar roar and crushed him in a bone-crunching hug.
"Ned! Ha-ha! But it's good to see that frozen face of yours!"
The king looked him over,
from top to bottom and laughed. You have not changed at all.
Would that Ned had been able to say the same. 15 years passed when they had ridden forth to win a throne. The Lord of Storm's End had been a clean-shaven, clear-eyed, and muscled like a maiden's fantasy. 6.5 feet tall, he towered over lesser men, and when he'd donned his armour and the great antlered helmet of his house, he became a veritable giant. He had a giant's strength, too. His weapon of choice, a spiked iron war hammer that Ned could scarcely lift. In those days, the smell of leather and blood had clung to him like perfume. Now it was perfume that clung to him like perfume, and he had a girth to match his height. Ned had last seen the king 9 years before, during Balin Greyjoy's rebellion, when the stag and the dire wolf joined to end the pretensions of the self-proclaimed king of the Iron Islands. Since the night they had stood side by side in Greyjoy's fallen stronghold, where Robert had accepted the rebel lord's surrender, and Ned had taken his son Theon as hostage and ward, the king had gained at least 8 stone. A beard as coarse and black as iron wire covered his jaw to hide his double chin and the sag of his royal jowls, but nothing could hide his stomach, or the dark circles under his eyes. Yet Robert was Ned's king now, not just a friend, so he said only, "Your Grace, Winterfell is yours." By then the others were dismounting as well, and grooms were coming forward for their mounts. Robert's queen, Cersei Lannister, entered on foot with her younger children. The wheelhouse in which they had ridden, a huge double-decked carriage of oiled oak and gilded metal, pulled by 40 heavy draught horses, was too wide to pass through the castle gate. Ned knelt in the snow to kiss the king's ring, while Robert embraced Catelyn like a long-lost sister. Then the children had been brought forward, introduced and approved of by both sides. No sooner had these formalities of greeting been completed than the king had said to his hosts, "Take me down to the crypt, Eddard. I would pay my respects." Ned loved him for that, for remembering her, still, after all these years. He called for a lantern. No other words were needed. The queen had begun to protest. They had been riding since dawn. Everyone was tired and cold. Surely they should refresh themselves first. The dead would wait. She had said no more than that. Robert had looked at her, and her twin brother Jamie had taken her quietly by the arm, and she had said no more. They went down to the crypt together, Ned and this king he scarcely recognized. The winding stone steps were narrow. Ned went first with a lantern. "I was starting to think we would never reach Winterfell," Robert complained as they descended. "In the south, the way they talk about my 7 kingdoms, a man forgets that your part is as big as the other 6 combined." "I trust you enjoyed your journey, Your Grace." Robert snorted. "Bogs and forests and fields, and scarcely a decent inn north of the Neck. I've never seen such a vast emptiness. Where are all your people?" "Likely they were too shy to come out," Ned jested. He could feel the chill coming up the stairs, a cold breath from deep within the earth. Kings are a rare sight in the north. Robert snorted. "More likely they were hiding under the snow." "Snow, Ned!" The king put one hand on the wall to steady himself as they descended. "Late summer snows are common enough," Ned said. "I hope they did not trouble you. They are usually mild." "The others take your mild snows," Robert swore. "What will this place be like in winter, I shudder to think?" "Oh, the winters are hard," Ned admitted. "But the Starks will endure, they always have." "You need to come south," Robert told him. "You need a taste of summer before it flees. In Highgarden there are fields of golden roses that stretch away as far as the eye can see. The fruits are so ripe, they explode in your mouth. Melons, peaches, fire plums, you've never tasted such sweetness. You'll see, I brought you some. Even at Storm's End, with that good wind off the bay, the days are so hot you can barely move. And you ought to see the towns, Ned. Flowers everywhere. The market's bursting with food.
The summer wine's so cheap and so good, you can get drunk, just breathe in the air. Everyone is fat and drunk and rich. He laughed and slapped his own ample stomach a thump. And the girls, Ned, he exclaimed, his eyes sparkling. I swear, the women lose all modesty in the heat. They swim naked in the river, right beneath the castle. Even in the streets, it's too damned hot for wool or fur, so they go round in these short gowns. Silk, if they have the silver, and cotton if not. But it's all the same when they start sweating, and the cloth sticks to their skin. They might as well be naked. The king laughed happily.
Robert Baratheon had always been a man of huge appetites, a man who knew how to take his pleasures. That was not a charge anyone could lay at the door of Eddard Stark. Yet Ned could not help but notice that those pleasures were taking a toll on the king. Robert was breathing heavily by the time they reached the bottom of the stairs, his face red in the lantern light as they stepped out into the darkness of the crypt.
"Your Grace," said Ned respectfully. He swept the lantern in a wide semicircle. Shadows moved and lurched. Flickering light touched the stones underfoot and brushed against a long procession of granite pillars that marched ahead, two by two into the dark. Between the pillars, the dead sat on their stone thrones against the walls, backs against the sepulchres that contained their mortal remains. "She is down at the end, with Father and Brandon." He led the way between the pillars, and Robert followed wordlessly, shivering in a subterranean chill. It was always cold down there. Their footsteps rang off the stones and echoed in the vault above as they walked among the dead of House Stark. The lords of Winterfell watched them pass. Their likenesses were carved into the stones that sealed the tombs. In long rows they sat, blind eyes, staring out into eternal darkness, while great stone direwolves curled round their feet. The shifting shadows made the stone figure seem to stir as the living passed by. By ancient custom, an iron longsword had been laid across the lap of each who had been lord of Winterfell, to keep the vengeful spirits in their crypts. The oldest had long ago rusted away to nothing, leaving only a few red stains where the metal had rested on stone. Ned wondered if that meant those ghosts were free to roam the castle now. He hoped not. The first lords of Winterfell had been men hard as the land they ruled. In the centuries before the dragon lords came over the sea, they had sworn allegiance to no man, styling themselves the kings in the north. Ned stopped at last and lifted the oil lantern. The crypt continued on into darkness ahead of them, but beyond this point the tombs were empty and unsealed, black holes waiting for their dead, waiting for him and his children. Ned did not like to think on that. "Here," he told his king. Robert nodded silently, knelt, and bowed his head. There were three tombs, side by side. Lord Rickard Stark, Ned's father, had a long, stern face. The stonemason had known him well. He sat with quiet dignity, stone fingers holding tight to the sword across his lap. But in life, all swords had failed him. In two smaller sepulchres, on either side were his children. Brandon had been 20 when he died, strangled, by order of the Mad King Aerys Targaryen, only a few short days before he was to wed Catelyn Tully of Riverrun. His father had been forced to watch him die. He was a true heir, the eldest, born to rule. Lyanna had only been 16, a child woman of surpassing loveliness. Ned had loved her with all his heart. Robert had loved her even more. She was to have been his bride. "She was more beautiful than that," the king said after a silence, his eyes lingering on Lyanna's face, as if he could will her back to life. Finally he rose, made awkward by his weight. "Ah, damn it, Ned. Did you have to bury her in a place like this?" His voice was hoarse with remembered grief. "She deserved more than darkness."
She was a Stark of Winterfell, Ned said quietly. This is her place.
She should be on a hill somewhere under a fruit tree, with the sun and clouds above her and the rain to wash her clean.
I was with her when she died, Ned reminded the king. She wanted to come home, to rest, beside Brandon and father. He could hear her still at times.
Promise me, she had cried, in a room that smelled of blood and roses. Promise me, Ned.
The fever had taken her strength, and her voice had been faint as a whisper. But when he gave her his word, the fear had gone out of his sister's eyes. Ned remembered the way she had smiled then, how tightly her fingers had clutched his as she gave up her hold on life. The rose petals spilled from her palm, dead and black. After that, he remembered nothing. They had found him, still holding her body, silent with grief. The little Crannog man, Harlan Reed, had taken her hand from his. Ned could recall none of it. I bring her flowers when I can, he said. Lyanna was fond of flowers. The king touched her cheek, his fingers brushing across the rough stone as gently as if it were living flesh.
I vowed to kill Rhaegar for what he did to her.
You did, Ned reminded him.
Only once, Robert said bitterly.
They had come together at the ford of the Trident while the battle crashed around them. Robert with his war hammer and his great antlered helm, the Targaryen prince armored all in black. On his breastplate was a three-headed dragon of his house, wrought all in rubies that flashed like fire in the sunlight. The waters of the Trident ran red around the hooves of their destriers as they circled and clashed, again and again, until at last a crushing blow from Robert's hammer stove in the dragon and the chest beneath it. When Ned had finally come on the scene, Rhaegar lay dead in the stream, while men of both armies scrambled in the swirling waters for rubies knocked free of his armor.
In my dreams, I kill him every night, Robert admitted. 1,000 deaths will still be less than he deserves.
There was nothing Ned could say to that. After a quiet, he said, We should return, Your Grace. Your wife will be waiting.
The others take my wife, Robert muttered sourly.
But he started back the way they had come, his footsteps falling heavily.
And if I hear Your Grace once more, I'll have your head on a spike. We are more to each other than that.
I had not forgotten, Ned replied quietly. When the king did not answer, he said, Tell me about John. Robert shook his head.
I've never seen a man sicken so quickly. We gave a tourney on my son's name day. If you had seen John then, you would have sworn he would live forever. A fortnight later, he was dead. The sickness was like a fire in his gut. It burned right through him.
He paused beside a pillar before the tomb of a Londed Stark.
I love that old man.
We both did, Ned paused a moment. Catelyn fears for her sister. How does Lysa bear her grief? Robert's mouth gave a bitter twist.
Not well, in truth, he admitted. I think losing John has driven the woman mad, Ned. She has taken the boy back to the Eyrie. Against my wishes. I'd hoped to foster him with Tywin Lannister at Casterly Rock. John had no brothers, no other sons. Was I supposed to leave him to be raised by women?
Ned would sooner entrust a child to a pit viper than Lord Tywin, but he left his doubts unspoken. Some old wounds never truly heal, and bleed again at the slightest word. The wife has lost the husband, he said carefully. Perhaps a mother feared to lose a son. The boy is very young.
6, and sickly, and Lord of the Eyrie, God have mercy, the king swore. Lord Tywin has never taken a ward before. Lysa ought to have been honored. The Lannisters are a great and noble house. She refused to even hear of it. Then she left in the dead of night, without so much as a by your leave. Cersei was furious. He sighed deeply. The boy is my namesake. Did you know that? Robert Arryn. I'm sworn to protect him. How can I do that if his mother steals him away?
I will take him as ward if you wish, Ned said. Lysa should consent to that. She and Catelyn were close as girls, and she would be welcome here as well.
A generous offer, my friend, the king said, but too late. Lord Tywin has already given his consent.
Fostering the boy elsewhere would be a grievous affront to him. I have more concern for my nephew's welfare than I do for Lannister pride, Ned declared.
That is because you do not sleep with a Lannister, Robert laughed, the sound rattling among the tombs and bouncing from the vaulted ceiling.
His smile was a flash of white teeth in the thicket of the huge black beard.
Ah, Ned, he said, you're still too serious.
He put a massive arm around Ned's shoulders.
I had planned to wait a few days to speak to you, but I see now there's no need for it. Come, walk with me.